Welcome to Sports Community Radio with your hosts, Steve Pallas and Jonah Vella, hosted at the studios of RPPFM, the voice of the peninsula, bringing you all the news and views around grassroots sports. Welcome to the show, Steve.
G'day, Joan. It's actually great to be in the studio. I haven't been in the studio for a couple of weeks.
You've been sauntering off all over the place, working hard.
Yeah, been up into the Pilbara. I saw it was 48 degrees there a couple of days ago. So last week I was in the sunny confines of Echuca in the Moyne Peninsula, just finishing the writing of, was the final chapters of the sponsorship book, which is still due out on the 25th of November, I'm hoping, but also very exciting, Joe. I was writing the tender for, hopefully we get to provide club development seminars in Western Australia, so that would be exciting if that was to eventuate.
Now, we've got our usual segment, which is going to be all about the latest news in the world of grassroots sports, but I want to touch on a very special guest that we've got on today's show, Steve.
Yes, Joe, Cecilia Hemener, the Director of National Sport Research, Sport Research and Information at the Australian Sports Commission. And I spent 45. We can get her on the line. So, grants. I said last week that as we're coming towards the end of the year, that grants were slowing down. But as it turns out, there's quite a few grants coming up and opening. So, the ones that have come up will start in New South Wales. The New South Wales Football Facilities Fund. With the New South Wales government, and football in New South Wales typically means NRL, rugby league. And so grants are up to $75,000. Applications close on January the 9th, and facility fund is self-explanatory. Again, another self-explanatory grant, this time in Victoria. Victorian Sporting Uniforms Grant. Now, clubs can apply for up to $1,000 of funding for their sporting uniforms. And the program application shut on February the 5th. So you've got a fair bit of time to get your grant in, but get it in early and they might grant them early. Now, Joe, I really can't think of a reason why Victorian Sports Club wouldn't be applying for that grant, because the grant process itself is quite easy and all clubs need uniforms.
Absolutely.
And just one more. We'll just go to one of our favourite places in all of Australia, which is the Northern Territory. The Quick Response Program provides assistance to organisations quickly to attend for unforeseen expenses and maximise opportunities that need immediate funding. So typically between $5,000 and $10,000, applications closing on the 31st of May 2015. So if you're in the Territory and something unforeseen happens, there is money there that can support you through a challenging time. So, Joe, there's still plenty of grants. There's probably 50 or 60 grants open at the moment, and these can be accessed on the Sports Community website, www.sportscommunity.com.au. Click on the Grants tab.
Okay, mate, so walk us through what's caught your attention in terms of the world of sport, grassroots sports and sports clubs over the last week.
Yeah, well, it's more so the news that's happening at the professional side that caught my attention, which we can apply back to grassroots. And I'm just writing an editorial that will be out before this podcast comes out about sports lack of innovation and lack of desire to innovate. And I guess that's following on from our discussion last week, Joe, on you know, Greg Norman telling, really encouraging golf to think like a kid, and the Orienteering Club who changed the face of orienteering in their club by creating a junior program that was linked to a treasure hunt. So that was really, really innovative thinking. And The Age is carrying a story at the moment. It was published on the 10th of November called Day Night Tests, a Solution to Thin Crowds. So I noticed that the Sheffield Shield at the moment, they're playing day-night Sheffield Shield games with the pink ball. And certainly from the commentator's perspective, I haven't heard too much feedback from the player's perspective, but from the commentator's perspective, the spectacle and the pink ball have added to the occasion. And so James Sutherland, the CEO of Cricket Australia, is now looking at, putting out there into the public discussion that they might actually look at day-night tests. And I think that's great, Joe.
I think it is great. Now, the other interesting piece of news along those lines as well was the fact that the Bushrangers are going to be playing some of their, I think it's 2020 or Sheffield Shield games in the Northern Territory as on account of the fact that they can't get access to grounds. Now, that seems to me an incredible turn of events for what is one of our premier sporting teams in the country. I mean, it's great for the Northern Territory. They've obviously put up their hand to help the Bushrangers out, but probably a little bit of a sad state of affairs down here where they can't get a house to play their game.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think from record, Melbourne is the only city, capital city in the country that doesn't have two Shield quality venues. And there's a lot of discussions going on about with cricket and AFL and state and federal governments about creating another venue, whether it be at the Junction Oval.
I think Geelong might have been muted as well.
Geelong, that was one of the reasons Geelong put the lights in, was to get a 2020 bash team, big bash team, which they were ultimately unsuccessful. I think watch that space. So yeah, it's interesting. And And I guess part of the reason for me bringing it up, Joe, is one, it's about the innovation, but two, it's about the strategic thinking of the sports. I think the sports are now moving to be innovative.
Yes.
And you raise the Northern Territory. I mean, clearly part of their strategy for raising the awareness of the territory and attracting tourism and people to the territory is through sports and major sporting events. So whether it be in the last 6 months since we've been working with the territory, there's been A-League games, there's been AFL games in Alice Springs, there's been the Australian A-team played a number of 5-day or 4-day games up in Darwin, Palmerston, I think. Basketball's been there, so pretty much their women's basketball has definitely been there. So again, there's another organisation that's got a clear objective. And
I have to say, like, if you're a sports lover, I mean, we're both Melbourne boys. Well, just outside of Melbourne. For those of you who aren't familiar with Victoria, we're on the peninsula, which is about 40 minutes away from the city of Melbourne.
That's the Mornington Peninsula.
The Mornington Peninsula. But often been hailed the capital of sport in the world, Melbourne. But I've got to say, if you're a sports lover, after doing a lot of work with the Northern Territory, the NT is a place to be because they look after their grassroots and their sports like, I'd have to say, in my opinion, like no other place that I've been in this country.
Sorry, Joe, my computer started talking to me. Look, I couldn't agree with you more. And having now travelled there 3 times in the last 12 months, the diversity of sport is a lot greater than what we traditionally have easily accessed here in say Melbourne, which we do consider, although recognised as the second or third behind London, as this, apparently London's the sporting capital of the world.
Joe, I say Melbourne, but you can say London.
Well, I don't say London, but the experts have decided that it's London, so I don't rate them as experts. But the territory is a fantastic place, as is places like Canberra as well.
Just out of interest, because I think a lot of folks down here would be interested, and all around the country, we obviously there's population numbers to consider. But in the territory, they have a coupon scheme. Just like in 30 seconds, can you kind of give us an insight as to how they manage sport using that coupon scheme?
Yeah, Northern Territory, it's called sports vouchers. Western Australia,
vouchers. Apologise. Yep.
Western Australia have also got one, and Queensland have also got a similar program where the government subsidises in the Northern Territory specifically. Joe, you were talking. The government subsidises or creates $100 voucher that they give to school age kids twice a year, which
then, every child,
yeah, every child. Well, in the territory, it's every child. Slightly different in Queensland and Western Australia, and so the child gives those vouchers to their sporting club, and the sporting club goes and redeems them. So that's one way of the territory and Queensland and Western
Australia.
See,
that to me is amazing, and I'm sure our listeners out there from who are not part of those states or territories would think the same way. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's a great commitment, and certainly as a parent, you'd embrace it. But speaking of engaging in sports at the grassroots level, Joe, The other article that got my attention, and it's a rugby league article in the Courier Mail in Brisbane. And it tells of Cameron Smith, who's the mighty Cameron Smith, the Melbourne Storm captain. So the mighty captain of Australia, captain of Queensland as well, but he's Melbourne's own, Joe.
Now?
Not now.
Forever. Capital of the world.
Forever. Cameron Smith calls for a summit on the schedule pushing elite players to breaking point because in our NRL, obviously they play their season, they play the State of Origin in the middle, they've got their tests, and they've got different competitions in the after season. But it got me thinking about the amount of sport that kids play. And a lot of kids are playing multiple sports four, five, six times a day. A week. And there was, in our local newspaper, there was a story, and the young lad's name, it was a couple of weeks ago at the end of the footy season. His name escapes me right now, but the story was about how he played in the junior, I think it was the under 13s, the under 15s final for Aussie Rules. Dominated, got best on ground, the team won. He had a 2 or 3 hours break, which he spent the whole time shooting hoops. Had his basketball grand final that afternoon. And he dominated, got best on court, and the team won. But it was more so the workload of that kid and through the season. And through my travels around the country, Joe, I'm seeing a lot of kids playing a lot of sports really intensively, and thinking that there probably needs to be some discussion about how much is too much sport too. And I never thought I'd say those words, but Cameron Smith's talking about it from the elite level, but I'm wondering about some of the long-term maybe injuries or problems that's arising from too much sport. So, but again, it may not be the case because we both grew up playing sport 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times a week, and well, we're not normal, but we're both carrying injuries now, which. I like to put mine down to lack of attention when they occurred, and 30 years of neglect more so than overuse. But I don't know, Joe. It's something that I think is going
to
become.
It's a tough issue. One because how do kids make it to the elite level without that kind of intense desire and hunger and motivation and work ethic? I mean,
But I was coming at it more from multiple sports perspective, you know, the footy on the one day, the basketball on the next day, the athletics on the next day, swimming on the next day type scenario, rather than an investment in a particular sport. Yep. But, yeah, I don't know. It's interesting, and Cameron Smith just got me thinking. So Joe, that's what we like to do. We like to think.
We do.
We like to think and we like to talk. We prefer to talk than think, obviously.
And our next guest is going to give us plenty to think about.
And she prefers to think rather than talk. So we'll take a break and we'll come back and look forward to us then.
You're listening to Sports Community Radio with your hosts, Steve Pellis and Joe Novella, another Sports Community digital production, courtesy of www.sportscommunity.com.au. Okay, welcome back. As mentioned at the top of the show, we've got a very, very special guest with us today here on Sports Community Radio on RPPFM, the voice of the peninsula. Her name is Cecilia Hermana. She is the director of the National Sport Research from the Australian Sports Commission. Welcome to the show, Cecilia.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Cecilia, it's Steve Pellis. Yes, we're very excited to have you on the show today. And I firstly wanted to start with congratulations for you and your team for the research that your team has been doing into the grassroots sports and the challenges and the way forward. From our perspective, we've been all over the research and we think it's just staggering and outstanding. So congratulations to you and your team.
Thank you. I'm delighted to hear that it's posing a value to the sector, which was our intention.
Oh, and very much so. I had a long conversation with a CEO of a Victorian major peak sporting body yesterday. And he had seen one of the presentations of the market segmentation into volunteering research, which we'll talk about in a little minute. And he was thinking that it was going to reframe the way that they approached educating their clubs about volunteering and engaging volunteers and creating opportunities for volunteers and those sorts of things. So it's really is making a tremendous benefit into the grassroots sport for sure.
Right.
Now, last week, Joe, you had the pleasure of interviewing one of Cecilia's colleagues, Robert Bennett, and he was talking about the market segmentation research into participation. But today we're lucky enough to have Cecilia, who's going to talk to us about one of the most recent pieces of research, which is market segmentation into volunteering. So take us back to the reason for the research and how it was conducted, and then we'll get into what we learnt and those sorts of things as we go.
Okay, great, sure. Look, the market segmentation for volunteers really is part of a broader program of research that I've had the pleasure of leading for the Commission. It's an integrated evidence-based approach to really understanding the sporting sector and how our consumers engage with the sport if we think of it as a product. So we originally started with the market segmentation for sport participation. So we looked at how adults engage in sports and other types of competitive leisure activities that they may choose to engage in instead, as well as looking at the types of motivations and barriers that present for our children and their perceptions around how they view club sport and, of course, their attitudes and behaviours towards participating in club sport. So we originally started with a clear view on wanting to understand the actual consumer. There's a couple of other pieces of work that we won't get into today, but perhaps at another time we'll be able to come back and delve into. We've added another overlay for the market segmentation for participation by including parents to understand that interplay between a child's decision to play club sport and their parental decision to play sport, as well as looking at participation for disability. So I guess that kind of rounds off understanding the consumer. This piece for volunteers really now is starting to tackle the idea around the actual delivery side of sport. So if we understand how people wish to engage in sport, what motivates them to play sport, what motivates them to go and try or participate in other types of non-club, non-organised type activities, we really need to understand how is sport being delivered. Because sport is really delivered on the backbone of our hard-working volunteers, we want to provide the same sort of consumer insight we had to the delivery side, and I guess this is where the kind of volunteer segmentation stems from.
One of the things that you said right at the start of that, which, excuse me, I think is a monumental change in thinking about sport, is sport as a product and actually listening to the consumer and the fact that consumers even exist in sport. And one of the things that sport's been very proud of is its tradition, and part of tradition is that I had a discussion with a guy who had just come back from the World Series, and one of the comments about baseball at the World Series was that, you know, the Rip Van Winkle concept, you could go to sleep for 30 years and you wake up and the game is exactly the same, and they saw that as a strength of the game. And a lot of sports have taken that position, whether it's a conscious or unconscious position, But you've started the research on the concept that sport is a product, and in the business world, products would evolve, and so therefore, sport needs to evolve, and that evolution should be driven by the consumer. Where did that position come from? Because that's not our experience of the position that the peak sporting bodies take about sport, although it is changing pretty quickly.
Yeah, look, I think one of the things that I was particularly motivated to pursue here within the Commission, having come from a commercial background, one of the things was glaringly obvious to me in trying to establish this body of work was the need to have a consumer-centric focus.
Yeah.
and quite often, and I think this is part of the kind of historical heritage, if you like, of how sport has been played out within Australia and has been extremely successful and how it's been experienced and delivered to Australians. The change of in terms of the way we live our lives, you know, having two parents who are working,
yep.
the explosion of the digital space, all of the different leisure opportunities that are now available to us, the different cultural makeup, the change in ageing demographics, all of those things has led us to a different point in time where society is quite different to 20 years ago.
Mm.
And the model of delivery for some sports is still reflected in a 20-year-old model.
Yes.
And so from an evidence point of view, what we wanted to do was to actually have a bit of a paradigm shift and forget not only sports but also government, to think about sport in a suite of leisure opportunities that the consumer has and being very, very consumer-focused, because ultimately what we're asking people to do is to make a decision based on their share of wallet. So where will I spend my dollar and where will I allocate my time when life is so busy now already and we have pressures on our time, we have pressures on our wallet, and ultimately we've got to deliver something that the consumer wants. Now, this isn't to say that traditional delivery of sport is no longer relevant, right?
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
There are many people who love their sport, who love their club. But what we also know is that there are changes that are afoot within the community where that preference has changed. And so this work was really to try and help sports understand that there are different preferences that they could perhaps tailor their product or their delivery to that would result, hopefully, in a much more effective outcome for them.
Well, Joe and I both come from a very strong business background, so it was interesting that we looked at it very, very much the same as what you have coming from your business background, but and we will get to the research, I promise. But what's been the feedback from the peak bodies coming from this position as sport as a commodity being consumer driven or demand driven as opposed to traditional being supply driven? Has it been embraced? Has it been understood? Has it been or has there been quite a lot of resistance in sticking to the tradition and or how's it been received? Because that's just a monumental change in thinking from what we see every day.
Yeah, look, I think it's been very much embraced by the sector. I think there are some sports that have probably embraced it a bit earlier. I think that in general, though, most sports understand that things have changed within society. I think the biggest challenge, though, however, is being able to work within current structures and with the current workforce
yep.
to try and affect that change. The reality, unfortunately, though, is, you know, traditional club sport delivery is competing with some very slick private providers.
Yes.
But, you know, sport really has something that these other private providers don't have, and this is something that sport could really capitalise on. And so sport in the heart and minds of Australians has a very, very strong place, and this hasn't gone at all. But what we need to do is try and provide the opportunities for people in which they want to engage in that fits in with their lifestyle and their life stages, right? And so this yep. is where private providers do very, very well.
Yes.
And so, you know, in answer to your question, I think that the understanding that there is a need to think about additional ways to engage the consumer or the, you know, our children and our adults to play our sport, I think that is well accepted now.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So the research itself, take us through about how, I mean, because you said evidence-based, which means talking to real-life people. How did you go about doing that? How big was the sample and how many people did you speak to and who did you speak to?
So look, we spoke to people from the ages of 14 right up to 80 years of age. in every state and territory in Australia, in both capital cities and regional locations. We did about 19 focus groups, which is about roughly around 180 people. So we had quite a very in-depth qualitative phase.
Yep.
Where we went out and spoke to a range of different people from all walks of life, all ages, all different types of cultural backgrounds, parents, grandparents, people who volunteer in sport, people who don't volunteer in sport, people who volunteer generally. And then we developed what we like to call a conceptual theoretical segmentation model based on all of those emerging themes and concepts and behaviours and attitudes that emerged from the qualitative phase. We then developed a questionnaire to try and quantify it. And by that I mean we tried to actually size up each of the segments within the Australian volunteer marketplace. So we surveyed 3,300-odd individuals right across Australia to try and measure the size of the different segments that we were able to identify. Now, the segmentation model identified 10 volunteer and non-volunteer segments, 5 that actually volunteer and 5 segments that don't volunteer.
Absolutely. So just to be clear in the discussion, how did you define volunteering?
Yeah, look, we spent quite a lot of time kind of thinking through this question before we started our research, and we actually chose to take a broader approach to defining volunteering than, say, the Australian Bureau of Statistics. We understand that the way people volunteer in sport is quite different to the way Australians volunteer generally in, say, not-for-profit or charity organisations. So we broadened the definition to include volunteering activities that occurred within the education sector, for instance.
Yep.
So recognising that many parents give their time to their child's school, whether it's reading assistance within class time, whether it's rocking up on sports days and helping out to do the time trials or looking after the, you know, holding the finish line tape at the end of a running race. We included that and actually broadened our definition to enable us to capture those types of volunteers. So, look, in terms of numbers, we found around 8.4 million Australians were volunteering, right? And of those 8.4 million Australians, 10% of those actually volunteered in sport, and then 7% of those volunteered in actual club sport. So remembering that our volunteer definition is much broader than the ABS's.
Wow. Wow. And so what did the research identify as the main motivations for volunteering? Why do people do it? Sport, I mean.
Yeah, look, I think the interesting thing with volunteering, and this is what we had to, I guess, deal with in the actual research that we conducted. We firstly looked at volunteering right across the board, right? So regardless of activity.
Yes.
What were the drivers and the motivations for people who volunteered? And then we honed down to look at what people actually did in relation to club sport volunteering. So broadly speaking, motivations to volunteer generally fell into three kind of key areas, and they're quite self-explanatory. You have the kind of the emotional kinds of motivations for volunteering, and these are things like caring and helping and looking for inspiration and giving back and social conscience and all of those types of things. There are also experiential motivations, right? So this is about creating an experience from that activity. So this could be about having some social connections or a sense of belonging or having an involvement in the community, about making friends and having fun. But there's something experiential about it.
Yep.
Then there are tangible motivations, right? So some people volunteer to get something directly back. Now, when we volunteer, we all get something, you know, regardless of what that might be. But there's a particular group who are primarily driven by a tangible experience. So this is about them wanting to get something back. So whether it's being able to participate in a hobby or to gain some professional skills or to practice some skills they might have learnt at university. There are set of tangible type benefits. Now, when it comes to sport, club sport volunteering, what we found is that they tend to fall within the experiential and the tangible motivation to volunteer. And one of the most interesting things, I think, that first stood out to me when we were looking at trying to understand the findings was that club sport volunteering to volunteers who volunteer in other types of organisations or sectors, and even club sport volunteers, don't actually see it as volunteering. Now, I know that sounds nearly contradictory, but volunteering in the broader sense was seen as giving back to a community that you probably aren't connected to, that are strangers to you.
Yes.
You know, the things that come immediately to mind are some of the charitable organisations like Meals on Wheels, St. Vinny, Uniting Care, the Red Cross, etc., etc. Right, so this is more of an altruistic giving back to a stranger.
Yes.
With not expecting a direct immediate return. When we come to club sport volunteering, people are often connected. More often than not, there's generally a direct relationship or a connection to that club sport. And they are generally doing it for some kind of tangible outcome, whether it's for an emotional thing or whether it's for, you know, enabling them to play their sport, or whether it's supporting their child to play their sport or to be a positive role model, to have social connection. There had to be some kind of direct relationship to that sport. So it's quite different to volunteering more broadly, which has some clear implications, I think, for how we manage our volunteer workforce within sport.
And I guess leading into that, what were those implications kind of coming out of it, out of that... have that learning and that research?
Well, look, I think to the credit of our sporting clubs, who really are the delivery hub of all sporting activities for Australians, you know, and within the community, the majority of people who are volunteering within club sport are highly satisfied with their experience, right? So yep. I think that's a huge pat on the back for the hard work that clubs are doing, who are predominantly, you know, led and driven by volunteers themselves. And also, you know, these volunteers are more often than not likely to volunteer the following year. So we know that when we get our volunteers in, most of them have a good experience, and we really want to retain those volunteers once we have them in. So we're wanting to reduce the churn. And often, that's about understanding how to provide opportunities and experiences for our volunteers that match their lifestyle stage. So volunteering in club sport very much mirrors the life stage that individuals are going through.
Gee, that's logical, isn't it? When you kind of step back and think about it, it's logical, but it's really when I was reading the report, it was really the first time I'd thought about it. We, in our training, we look at matching skill sets of volunteers to tasks, but not necessarily had we considered, well, not necessarily, we hadn't considered at all the life stage that they were in or at, and linking those people to the different tasks.
Yeah, and, you know, look, hopefully the value of this volunteer segmentation, it provides sports and clubs an idea of the type of makeup that their volunteer workforce kind of reflects. So, as an example, our happy helpers and our overcommitted segment, they tend to be the heartland of club volunteering, if you like. So, you know, each of those is about a third of our volunteer workforce within club sport.
Yes.
And so there are particular things for each segment that clubs will be able to use to help inform the way in which they manage them.
Yeah, and recruit and retain. What were some of the reasons, the barriers that were identified as part of the research?
Overwhelmingly, and this is for all segments, irrespective of you know, which segment they fall within. One of the primary kind of issues for people who were volunteering their time was feeling that their time was not valued, right, or that their skills weren't being put to good use. So people are giving up their time voluntarily, of course, and they really want to feel that they are getting the best out of that experience, but also their time is well spent. And so, you know, often I think because the way sometimes our organisations are resourced, things can be quite hurried and the experience of volunteers can be quite varied. So as an example, when people turn up to volunteer for the first time, they want absolute clarity on the role that they're going to be playing.
Yeah.
If we say that the volunteering activity is only going to take an hour, it needs to take an hour and not five.
Yes.
Right, as an example. They need to be able to understand where to go, to be able to do things well. They need a clear set of instructions, and they also need to be able to speak to somebody if they are confused or unsure of what they have to do. So there's some quite, I think, logical things that most clubs would recognise themselves and often are doing a pretty good job at it. But these things, where they fall down, are the triggers for people to stop volunteering.
Yeah. Okay, so if we just explore that concept of recognition and reward, I mean, in our dealings and training with the clubs, this is a fundamental change that needs to occur, because traditionally in clubs, well, say a generation ago, the majority of the work was done by the committee, and so therefore the committee was loath to acknowledge and recognise the reward the efforts of the committee, because it looked a little bit condescending that they were, you know, giving themselves a pat on the back. But in today's society, you know, the really strong and successful clubs are those clubs that have got just about everyone in their club participating and contributing in some way, shape or form. So the concept of, you know, the way you get positive, the way you get the behaviour, repeated behaviour, is positive reinforcement. So the concept of continually recognising and rewarding and reinforcing that positive behaviour is something really foreign to clubs. So did the research come up with any ways or suggestions about how clubs could really effectively, I guess what they're saying when they're feeling that their time was not valuable is that they were taken for granted. So how do we turn that position around in club land and kind of go the opposite and feel like the person's time is not only appreciated, but, you know, valued, as and you said, and really appreciated and cherished?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, how much do you reward and recognise, and what does it actually look like? Is it a end-of-year barbecue to help all our volunteers? Is it the pat on the back by the head of the club or the various teams to thank the volunteers? Look, I think it's all of those things. But ultimately, what we know from our research is that people want to know that their time is valued. So if an activity is really well organised, that there is absolute clarity, that there's adequate training and support, these things will lead to ongoing volunteering. If you then follow that up with appropriate recognition, and this varies, I think, from sport to sport and club to club, and they can be quite simple things. I mean, you know, thanking them as well as having, some kind of public acknowledgement, they're all nice things, but they have to go hand in hand. So well-organised, well-structured and clarity with the acknowledgement and recognition, both formal and informal.
Yeah.
Those things seem to be most desired by our different volunteers. And look, I think, not to try and jump too far ahead, but I think what we also found, which was quite interesting, is that people who volunteer in large events, right, which generally are very, very well run, there are some things in event volunteering that could be gleaned for clubs, for instance. You know, there's some things in there that they could learn and on a much smaller scale, look to try and adopt within their own club structure. So, you know, they're the same things, and I think, you know, one of the best things about this research is that it really validates what we intuitively already know, and that is that we need, that people are looking for well-organised, well-structured, volunteering activities that match their life stage. So when we talk about life stage, for instance, parents are one of the biggest acquisition pools of volunteering talent that sport has access to. Most of our parents said, 9 out of 10, if you like, of the parents who surveyed said that they would do some type of volunteering activity if they asked me directly.
Yeah, yes, 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 yes. So how did you break down the different stages of life? You know, you're talking about life stages. So how did you break that down, and what were the different characteristics of each stage?
Yeah, look, it also matches, and this is one of the, I think, the valuable things with doing the volunteer segmentation following our market segmentation for broad participation. When we talk about life stage, we're talking about those stages of development from childhood through to teenagers, through to young adulthood, through to being an adult, you know, where you start having full-time employment, you've finished study, you're starting to have a family, you've got a young family, you then move into primary school-age children, your children get older, become teenagers, they leave the home, you've got an empty nest, and you're ageing, right? So it's about life stage across an individual's lifespan. Mm. And so we know that individuals have very different needs at each of those lifespan, life stages. Children and teens, you know, they're obviously looking for their growth and development as a child. As they enter into their teenage years, they're looking for self-identity. They're starting to be exposed to different experiences. Peer groups become very, very important. And then, you know, they move into the age bracket where they're starting to go out with their friends, they are, you know, having relationships, going to university, and so on. So what we try and do is we try and think about aligning not only opportunities for them to play sport, but also opportunities for them to volunteer in sport that matches the available time and interest that they have at those different life stages.
Cecilia, it's Joe here. I just wonder if the research identified any mismatch between ages, sports, and maybe even cultural backgrounds as to the propensity for people to volunteer. So do we see a larger majority of one demographic wanting to volunteer as opposed to maybe emerging communities or teenagers, for example?
Yeah, look, that's a really interesting question, and look, the short answer is yes. So, for instance, our happy helpers tended to be female. They tended to be from kind of middle-income families. They tended to have young children, and they were very, very happy to volunteer, hence the name happy helpers. The overcommitted, for instance, tended to be male, tended to be professional, and tended to volunteer in a whole range of activities. And so each of those segments, we can see sometimes there's a gender skew and sometimes there's an age skew. So, for instance, the sideline segment of volunteers, or non-volunteers, I should say, tended to be older, and they tended to be people with physical limitations, for instance. So their volunteering was quite limited because of their issues around mobility and so on. So there certainly was some differences by gender and by age, and also by education and by income. Now, the cultural diversity thing is quite an interesting element, and I think we're going to see more and more of this in Australia as our cultural makeup changes over time with the different migration flows that come into Australia. So the work that we did, for instance, in the Future of Australian Sport, that piece of research where we partnered with CSIRO, looked at some of those population demographic shifts and changes. And so, speaking, I guess, just broadly, if we think about some of the new migration flows that are coming into Australia from some war-torn countries, for instance, the refugees who are coming into Australia may come from a cultural background that didn't have a strong element of volunteering. Now, whether that's cultural or it's because of the environment in which they've come from, volunteering isn't the mainstay for them. So volunteering here might be quite a foreign concept to them, coupled with the kind of makeup of clubs themselves. And sometimes, you know, when we look at our culturally and linguistically diverse communities, what they're looking for is familiarity and a sense of welcoming. Now, if you go into a club environment and you don't see anyone who looks like you, who comes from a place like you, who doesn't speak a language like you and has different values or perceived differences, because quite often, you know, as humans, we all have similar values, but how it's manifested could be quite different. We have an issue for club sports where, you know, there's an attitudinal behavioural change that has to occur with these new communities. So that has quite long-reaching, I think, implications for sport.
Yeah, absolutely. The other really interesting question for us as well is, and probably just continuing on that theme, is with teenagers, for example. Well, it gets more back to what the idea of volunteering is, because volunteering is almost an ethos. It's almost something that identifies Australian society. And as you touched on before, you have a different, slightly different definition of volunteering to what maybe the Australian Bureau of Statistics does. Do you think that there are some elements of the research demographic that maybe the concept or the idea of volunteering hasn't penetrated? And I'm saying that because I put myself in a club environment, and if I'm dealing with teenagers, for example, it's quite well known now that teenagers are always on their phones, and they might be labelled as
what's in it for me.
What's in it for me? So it's almost a what's in it for me generation. So
yeah.
I guess the question is: are we doing enough as clubs to make that message of volunteering, which has been such a staple of Australian society, permeate through to these new participants in sport?
Look, I think this is an area for significant growth, right, in terms of how we manage a new look workforce that we have for sporting clubs within Australia. There are two segments in particular, if we think about our volunteer segmentation, which is very much skewed to the youth. Right? So these are our, what we call self-service and what we call our opportunists. Now, but they're quite closely related. But I think the self-servers, you know, there's potential to try and acquire some of these, because these types of volunteers, self-serving volunteer segments, are often highly educated, highly mobile, and also very ambitious. So they're looking for an opportunity to add some kind of experience to their CV, to help them with their job search or to help them move up the corporate ladder. Yeah. And so, you know, being able to tap into educational institutions to try and grab those marketing students or those communication students or those business development students and give them an opportunity to try and develop some kind of strategic view for a sporting club at no cost, you know, is a win-win.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I'm just thinking about how many times I've lost arguments in training sessions with people trying to explain the concept of accessing students. And typically the only arguments we lose in the training sessions are the ones where we don't have it backed by evidence. And now you've given us that evidence it's just fantastic. So it's the evidence that changes people's behaviour and changes people's thinking. And I know that we've taken up a lot of your time, but if I can just take up two or three more minutes just to convert In a way that we, because you will have worked out, and our listeners know very much that John and I are very simple folk, that that convert it into a way that we understand. So the best way is to apply it to our world. So you've now taken over the presidency of, you know, one of, you know, child or relatives or friend or your own sports club for reasons that you, you know, fell into the trap that I promise if you come to the AGM, you don't have to be on the committee, and now you're president. So with what you know, and if in our world, when we get travel around the country as we do, the for us, the difference between successful clubs, however you measure success, which is typically by their own objectives, and those that are not so successful are those that have engaged their membership or their workforce to contribute to the achievement of the goals. So you're now the president. What do you do? What are the steps in, that you're going through to first of all recruit, engage, and motivate and lead your workforce? Like from the structural steps, not the, you know, talk to this person and talk to that step, but I'm talking more procedural, structural steps that we can create a framework around.
Look, I think that's a very interesting and challenging question, and I'll give it my best shot. But look, I think if I was the club president, the first thing I would do is make retention the priority. Right, so looking at my current kind of volunteer workforce and having a very clear view of the types of volunteers that I currently have and what they are, how they are volunteering, and understanding that within my current volunteer base, they probably are going to fall within five of those segments that I previously mentioned, with the majority of them falling within three. And then I would look at making sure that there was clarity of role. So, you know, if I go back to the actual research, the greatest threat to retention is the view that volunteers have that their time is not being used productively.
Yes.
So it would be, you know, really have a look at all of the kind of activities that we have where people are volunteering and making sure that they are extremely clear and well organised. That would be my absolute first priority. And then, you know, once I'd established that, I would then look at where some of the gaps are in terms of, you know, the types of roles that we have and where we could possibly plug those. So this might be skill set, for instance, for retired individuals who want to give back but don't actually think of sport as being the first port of call, or it's about approaching the educational institutions and being able to recruit in some of the skills that we are looking for. And having a clear view on the full range of volunteering activities, including the amount of time that things would take, right?
So yes, yes.
Quick volunteer engagement versus the kind of long sustained roles that we have, and whether some of those can actually be broken down. Now, this though, you know, this is a significant piece of work for any club president to go through. But, you know, if you ask me and I wore that hat, then that would probably be one of the first things that I would do.
And we couldn't agree with you more. A fantastic way to finish. Cecilia Hemener, thank you so much. Director of National Sport and Research, thank you so much for spending, you know, 40 minutes talking to, for what we, from where we come from, probably some of the most groundbreaking, well, certainly a series of most groundbreaking research I think's ever been done in Australian sport. And we take your hat off to you, and we would love to have you back on the show anytime that you wanted to come and talk about what you learned and how we can apply that learning to grassroots sport.
Look, thank you very much. That's a big accolade, and hopefully we can live up to that. And look, I'd love to come back and share with you the research that we've recently completed with parents. So this is understanding the interchange between decision-making between a parent and their child and which activity they actually are involved in. I would just like to finish with one last comment as well, which is to acknowledge all the fantastic work that people are doing out in clubland. And certainly, you know, what we're asking and what the consumer is expecting of sport is quite a fundamental change, and it's a big challenge for our sporting fraternity out there to be able to do this. You know, behavioural change, as we all know, takes a long time. We need to change attitudes, and we need to change behaviour, and that's done over a period of time. And look, I'd invite everyone to go to our the Clearinghouse on the Commission website. You can access all of our research and material on www.researchandsport.com, and it's all there free and available for anyone who's working within sport.
Fantastic. And the one thing that people need to change is the reason to change, and that's what you've given them. So thank you so much for sharing that with us today, and we will probably be knocking on your door so often that you'll be sick of us over time. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you today.
Thanks very much for the opportunity.
You're listening to Sports Community Radio with your hosts Jonah Vella and Steve Pallas. If you've missed a couple of our episodes, why not visit our website at www.sportscommunity.com.au. And there you'll find all our previous podcasts that you can download. And while you're there, give us a review so you can help spread the news about Sports Community and its services to the grassroots sports clubs. Okay, we've come to the end of the podcast. We hope you've enjoyed the content today, and hopefully it will be of use to you and your sports club and your volunteers. As we also need to mention that we're proud to be associated with RPPFM, in whose studios we record this podcast. Okay, so on behalf of me, Jonah Vella.
And me, Steve Pallas, thank you for making us part of your sports community.